Water Rights Advisory Council meeting for February 2011. Water right now. Thank you very much. Thanks all for coming here. Let them cooperate, do not conspire against us tonight. We have, last month we had three new members participating in our discussion, and tonight we have an additional two, Steve Claremont and Joseph Kitchen. As you know, later in the meeting, we're going to have time for introductions, so that'll be a chance for us to get to know them and them to get to know us as well. We have two special guests with us tonight, and so I'd like to get through the business of the public comment and approval of agenda and past meeting minutes, and then we'll head right into the meeting. So, public comment.
Good evening, all. I'm leaving shortly. I want to have a good meeting. I would like to stay if only to get an answer to the question after my minute is up.
Phil,
just touch the
good evening, all. Have a good meeting. I have no way of knowing if the accuracy of what was in this morning's agenda is total or in part, only in part true. But I'm here tonight requesting the board, only outside of the merits of the issue, bag searches, random searches, profiling, theater, whatever. Only outside of the merits of the issue, I'm here to suggest that notwithstanding a new title for the general manager, that being general manager and CEO, it's inappropriate for whoever holds that position to make policy, which suggests to me in the story this morning, if it's accurate, the new general manager, CEO, has chosen to do. The board just last week, in response to Rex's letter, suggested that they were going to farm out the issue for further review to a committee and receive public comment. And I read this morning, if it's accurate, that the general manager, CEO, has determined that notwithstanding whatever the board did last week, the bag searches, random theater, et cetera, will remain. My minute is up. I said what I had to say, although I'd be happy, even though I have to run, to hear whether or not it was accurate, you know, what I read this morning.
Thank you, Bill.
I thought that person might wish to say whether it was accurate. Well, if you'd like to. And I'm glad, by the way, that was his appointment. I just don't like what I saw this morning.
To answer your question, one is the Board of Customer Service Committee, which was referred to, we'll discuss next week. And I did say that bag searches will continue. Bag searches for bag searches.
Until such time as that committee meets?
The board will make its own decisions. But at the moment, the bag scans will continue.
Do I have 40 seconds left? Well, I would urge the Riders Advisory Council to reemphasize to the board its demand contained in this letter of the general board last week. Thank you very much. You all have a good evening.
Thank you, Bill. There are no other public comments, so we'll move to approval of the agenda. If there are no objections, we'll consider it approved. Seeing none, it's approved. Approval of past meeting minutes. Carol?
I wonder, can we do this after, can we move back to item six? Let's move the approval of the minutes to item six.
Okay. If there are no objections, we'll move that to, we'll move the meeting minutes to past item six. And I think I know why, so that we can get right into the rest of the meeting. Thank you, Carol. Our first guest, in some ways, needs no introduction. If you've read the paper or listened to the radio or TV, he is the man of the hour in the city. I was very pleased last year when Mr. Sauls was named the interim general manager, that he, as one of his first acts, came to visit the Riders Advisory Council. And last week, when he was just last week, he was appointed general manager and CEO, and I'm even more delighted that now that he's going to be a permanent fixture, he also made it a point to come to visit the Rise Advisory Council. So, Mr. Sauls, congratulations and welcome.
Thank you. I'll tell you, I actually have come to enjoy this job. It's got a lot of challenges to it, but I enjoy that. I think there's a good team here at WMATA that wants to make this a better place. So that's why I'd be considered, and of course, chosen for it, whatever reason they've chosen for it. Well, let me just talk about a lot of what I tend to do is a continuation of what's gone on the last 10 months. When I came down here, signed up only to be interim, I said then that I just wanted to get some building blocks in place for the person who would name general manager permanently. And that's what we set about last year. I'm not going to repeat all of it, but certainly the focus is on safety. That's going to continue to be the focus in terms of the number one priority, is to do everything we can to improve the safety culture here. We made certain investments last year. We're going to continue those investments this year, and they'll start to bear fruit as we find better ways to run a safer system. This runs everything from listening to our employees, communicating our expectations to employees, and really having a good dialogue and feedback and supporting everyone as they work more safely and travel more safely. A big part of this, and we accomplished it last year, was the six-year capital funding agreement for $5 billion. And what that does is make major investments in safety, which we're going to be working on for several years. Buying the 7,000 series cars to place the 1,000 series cars, that's a major effort. It's underway. There's a lot of other NTSB recommendations that we're addressing. We're going to spend $1 billion of that $5 billion just addressing NTSB recommendations for 7,000 series cars. Primary thing, replacing track surface modules and all that sort of thing, will continue. Combine that with the state of the repair, as you well know, the whole system. The red lines are roughly 35 years old. It's parts of it, good sized parts of it. It's the most heavily used line. It's worn out. The tracks are worn out. The signal size has issues. The track server modules, which are really costly. Stations, you know, need work. So we're going to be rebuilding over the next several years the model, Washington Metro. We're rebuilding the system. Part of it is. We're rebuilding our track, I already know. It grows up in interest every year. So you see us much more aggressively taking advantage of outages in terms of the work we have to do. And this is going to go on for a number of years. The ultimate goal for the passenger is a more reliable ride in the future so that you don't have as many unplanned outages. Suddenly a rail cracks or something like that. That shouldn't be happening. Rare circumstances. But because the age of the system, the way it's treated, not maintained as well as it should, that's going to continue for a while when we get this rebuilt. The next couple of years, we're working on the red line. We awarded a contract for the blue and orange lines last year, so the next 3 or 4 years, we're going to be working on that line also. There's a lot of work that's going to be done. It needs the patience of the customers to understand that outside the peak periods, on the weekends, we're trying to get a lot accomplished. It's just like a highway. You don't maintain a highway. All you do is patch the potholes. Eventually, it becomes a pretty rough ride, and you've got to rebuild a highway. And you have to shut down the lane to do it. And that's basically what we're doing here at WMATA. You don't see it, you know, because it's a track and tunnel or something like that, but it's the same sort of thing that we have to do. So that continues to be one of my top priorities. Hopefully, we've gained financial stability. We talked about that a lot last year. However, there's a major threat to that, which could cause all the plans we put in place to unravel and seriously affect our ability to catch up and achieve a state of repair. And that's what's going on in Congress. Right now, there's discussion that we hear about a continuing resolution, maybe not including that $150 million appropriation for next fiscal year, as a cornerstone of a capital program. And of course, the jurisdictions are matching that. That will be devastating to us if that $150 million a year authorization is not turned into appropriation. Devastating. We will not be able to catch up in the state of repair. We will continue to fall further and further behind. So that is a major threat to the stability. We proposed a budget for FY12 that depends on that money. And Carol will discuss in the budget a little bit later. But it's very important that we preserve that. And we'll be working with the congressional delegation, with the groups around town. We obviously have great interest in seeing Washington Metro remain the vital link it is for some of our citizens. Getting on to, say, customer service. I started visiting with customers. I was out at Howard Place the other night, late afternoon, early evening, talking to people. People have talked to me about the topics I just mentioned, state of repair and stuff like that. They actually didn't talk to me much about the service. But they talked to me about two things, basically. One was the litter and debris on cars, especially, and recalling how, you know, a decade ago you just didn't see that. And the other was customer service, in terms of indifferent employees or sometimes rude employees and stuff like that. We all together have to try to educate our customers that they shouldn't be leaving papers on the trains, sometimes before the stations. They shouldn't be drinking and all and leaving their messes on the station. That's for all of us to do. I welcome suggestions from you. What we are going to do, and I've been talking to our folks about it, you know, we have the signs in the station trying to remind people not to eat drinks in the station and run cars. We're also going to be personally reminding people when they're seeing this is something we're going to reactivate over the next few months. I don't know where I don't get tickets out for this. I really would rather be more civil about it, remind people. That's what we're going to try to do, that they should be doing. So I'm addressing that. The subject of how some employees deal with customers, and I will say it's some because the nice thing when I first was here and it was the interim is nobody really knew who I was. So I could, and I use the system every day. I use it probably 6 days a week on average. And I could walk around, I could see how people were treated. And I'd say most of our folks treat people right. But there are some do what they should. You train them, and you try to refresh that training, and most people get it, a few don't. So what we're going to also try to do is, people complain to me, but they generally don't take down the details. Because we don't know exactly what bus it was on, exactly what time, our chances of figuring out who that driver was, we'll never get there. What we want to do is deal with that driver. We will deal with that driver if we know who that person is. We'll get the complaint. Certainly, if you get a series of complaints, you can do more. Same thing with the station manager. We want people to give us specifics, and we're going to try to highlight that as we go forward. Beyond that, I mentioned in my board remarks that we're going to reinstitute the secret shopper program, which is helpful. It doesn't solve all the problems. Where I've been previously, it does help us if we hear complaints, but we're not quite sure, that kind of stuff. We can send somebody out, check it out, and watch what's going on, and report back. Make some. It'll take time, but we intend to get that working this year. Get reinstituted. We're having an independent assessment coming out of our customer service call center. Because you get sometimes similar complaints, or the fact that we don't respond appropriately or timely or something like that. So we're going to take a look at how effectively we operate that, and what changes may have to be made there. Those are some of the things going on. Customer, clerk finish in that area. One of the important things on the design of the 7000 series, and I mentioned this before and had some discussions on it, there has been customer input, I understand, under other planning this. But as we're going forward, and I think you mentioned that at a board meeting or not, we're in a conceptual design now. We're going to use custom research groups, focus groups, working with the industrial design that we are. I found in my past experience, both in the design itself, express interiors and exteriors, New Jersey Transit, double-decker cars, while customers do be, have ideas about how things should be. We're not good designers, so it's really translating what a customer desires into something that works from a design viewpoint. And I have found that hiring your own industrial designer that reports to you is not being paid for by the car manufacturers are helpful in advocating for using design details, but they make a difference in the long run. So we're going to be doing that. And as we move forward with conceptual design, we're going to do that with soft mock-up, computer mock-ups, you know, hard mock-ups. Customers are on, so that's the way of getting customer input. We also will have our maintenance folks there every step of the way so that it helps us design the right access for maintainability, easier to maintain the cars, and our operators so that the cab is ergonomically correct for them. If they have a happy employee, a comfortable employee, they probably should show up there. So, you know, those are the kinds of things that we have them on. And with that, I'm going to get to the Q&A part. Okay?
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Mr. Sauls. We'll follow our tradition of going around the room. If you have a question, if you could state it as briefly or succinctly as you can. And if you don't have a question, you can just say yes. So we'll start with that.
Thank you, Mr. Sauls, for being here. I wanted to follow up on your comments on the capital budget and focusing on safety. One thing that I've heard is that because of additional expenses, obviously associated with safety that are very, very important, there's not going to be the previously anticipated expansion of the fleet, the rail fleet. And I know that that can also end up resulting in a safety concern and crowding, and so I'm wondering how you see us or see the organization coping with that.
Well, you're absolutely right. Because of where we are and the needs out there for state good repair, there is not enough money to purchase additional cars, which can lead to problems. But I'm trying to deal with the most immediate tracks, signals, that sort of thing. Those are problems we know we have today. In the future, we get growth, and it can become an issue at stations. I understand that, but until we can convince the jurisdictions to provide more funding, we can't address that. It's all a matter of priority. It's simple. It's simply that. The verse is only so big at the moment. And now with this other threat, I'm even more concerned. It's just the fact of that.
Thank you very much also for speaking with us. You mentioned at the end of your remarks about the railcar design. In the RAC sent a letter about the railcar design, part of it was about sort of general customer input into it, but there was a specific part that I don't know if it was addressed, was a concern that in looking at, for example, the seating arrangements, there was not very much of an attention being paid by the car designers to how to accommodate more passengers so that we wouldn't have overcrowding in the future. It sounded like the decision had been made. I guess the question is, has a decision been irrevocably made about the seating arrangements and the capacities of the cars, transverse versus longitudinal seating and so forth? Or is that something that's still being decided? And were you involved in that decision, or was that sort of already made before you were here?
I recall. Because of the earlier customer input and evaluation, decision was made to go to transverse seating. However, in the design, the structural design of a car, in the future date, if things get too crowded, it can accommodate longitudinal seating. So you get the benefit of transverse seating now, it gets way too crowded, you can go to the longitudinal seating in the future, which I think is, you know, retrospect from me looking at it, that's not a bad decision.
I want to follow up on something you said earlier about the federal funding. You said it's a major threat that the appropriations don't come through. I want to ask for you to, you know, kind of look in the crystal ball. What do you think likelihood with this new Congress and sort of some of the budget deficit cutting measures that they want to put in place? What is the likelihood of that funding being reduced?
I won't claim to be a real good political. However, I think it's significant enough concern that we should do everything possible on concerning the board and others. We're going to do everything possible to raise that concern to make sure that it's well known what in effect how it affects us. Because it not only affects us, I mean, $150 million only affects us, but the other part of it, and we've reflected in our more recent budget analysis, is the federal formula fund. We rely on also for capital needs, as well as everybody who owns a public transportation agency throughout the country is being rolled, talked about being rolled back. So we have to also address that now. The more immediate concern is the continuing resolution, which may come up next month. The next several months is the second matter, which I think will be a lot of allies throughout the country. So it is a serious concern, and I'm not taking that lightly.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for coming. I appreciate it. My role on this committee is to advise this committee on issues that the AAC is working on, particularly, and there's lots of crossover between certain areas, 7,000 rail car series being one of them. I would say that very much so this committee and what the AAC work together on, very much in sync, this emphasizing the riders, AAC emphasizing seniors and people with disabilities. So I think it's a good, very good working relationship. The one thing that I have noticed lately or over the last couple of weeks is that, and perhaps something that in you speaking with Christian can remind groups that are talking about disability issues or issues involving seniors is to come before the AAC committee and consult with this committee, because we tend to sometimes work at cross purposes in the disability community if the AAC committee is not consulted. As I said to Christian, perhaps the initial sentence could be from WMATA staff and also from you. And I would also say to the board, have you consulted with the AAC on these issues, so that just as this committee consults with us on disability issues, we need other groups to do the same thing, so that we come before you and we come before the board recommending one set of priorities and one set of solutions, as opposed to working at cross purposes. That's somewhat of a little bit of a promo, I guess, for the AAC, so I apologize for that. But since I have your attention a little bit here, I thought I'd say that.
I appreciate the comment. It did sound like a plug, but that was okay.
First, let me say that I appreciate your coming to talk to us so quickly after your formal appointment. I think we all appreciate that. One of the issues that we've discussed a lot over the last year, I'm sure it's the one that's constantly in front of you, and that is budget and funding and these kinds of things. And we had a lot of discussion in the past year kind of fare increases versus service cuts. And my view was very strongly that you can't cut services anymore. It's too vital a system, and you have to have fare increases. If push comes to shove, you have to have fare increases. That's generally where the committee came out, I think it was the middle of last year. What is your view on that? And I know these aren't absolutes, where you have service cuts versus fare increases, where do you come out of that?
They're both very difficult.
probably know, the budget I proposed this year, there's no fare increases and there's no service cuts. So that sort of says where I come out. As experiences, just what you said, I do not like fare increases. I like service cuts, but less so. So it's a balance, but not easy choices. The board ultimately makes it, but I've tended to try to preserve service.
Thank you.
Not always accomplished, but it's where I tend to go.
Just to get back to a previous point, this question and comment, how extensive of a lobbying and public campaign effort are you planning or considering on this congressional funding issue? And just from work I've done, I was looking at what certain groups are proposing in the budget. It's not just hostility towards mass transit. There's a very distinct hostility towards this area, the federal workforce, the transit systems, roads, everything. And just suggesting that beyond just consulting with other transit groups and systems in other cities and states, to work locally with AFSCME, with all sorts of groups that are going to be opposing the types of budget cuts that are happening, and well beyond the field of transportation. The big stuff that's being debated is going to make it possible on a whole variety of levels to invest in the infrastructure of this area and this country.
We're putting our strategy together, and part of the strategy is even what I'm talking to you guys tonight, as well as others, but a good part of that strategy is having other voices speak on behalf of us, or the need for this, and that's much more modern to say, but the need for this investment. And the more voices there are, I think the better you'll listen to them. So that's the kind of strategy that we're putting together and lining up other groups to speak from us on the same subject. The thing that I found, which is great in this area, is how supportive the business sector is for WMATA. Incredibly supportive. They realize how vital it is to the economy. And this current political setup, parties are in power and where? I think it's a good thing to have business groups strongly supportive of what we do.
Excuse me. You know, I was reading the Examiner this morning, and I don't know if you ran it all over the Examiner today. I actually want to talk about the other story that they wrestled to you in, and that concerns the budget. And the size of the workforce and things like that. I remember listening to you on WTOP talking about the need to fill vacancies within the system. We all know that overtime is what's really hurting the system as well. But then, so I guess if you can talk a little bit about the other article in the Examiner, which basically, in their way of doing it, takes aim at your at the expansion of the administrative staff here in this building, and at the same time as the, I think that's what a lot of people have a problem when they have a problem with Metro, is that on one end, you know, saying we have no money, we have to cut, we have to raise fares and things like that, and at the other end, we're going to increase the size of the administrative staff. And so if you can talk about that and also in the sense of if those are vacant positions that they need to be filled, or are they new positions that still need to be filled, and why they need to be filled?
Sure. And you'll get more of the budget presentation, but let me address that question directly. I'm going to use round numbers, okay? 260 positions was discussed in the article, and if you look at a sheet in our budget book, you can find that kind of number. Let me break it down. 160 of those positions have to do with capital investment. These are folks out in the tracks, repairing the tracks. These are folks, engineers. These are project managers. These are folks that are part of the overall capital program management, which I had mentioned over the last several months of the board we have put in place to actually advance the capital program. These are folks that I think 35 of those out of 60 were required for getting the workers, the contractors into the tunnels to put in the cell phone system that's mandated by Congress. So those 160 work positions are capital. They don't affect the operating budget at all. And if you're going to increase the capital program, which we have done, up to $800-some million, you're going to need more people working on it. That doesn't affect the operating budget at all. And most, if not all, those positions have been previously authorized by the board. So it's nothing in terms of sort of. There's about, roughly 65 positions that are in IT, computer area. If we are looking at, I haven't come to a conclusion, looking at whether we should replace existing contract employees, in other words, we hire people on contract and pay all the overheads, and replace them with employees that would be on staff, whether that would save us money. So that's a proposal, no definitive conclusion. Then, somewhat embarrassingly, but it's reflective of some of the old systems we have here, there's about 40 folks, positions I should say, that were already in the fiscal year 11 budget, this year's budget, and the money was provided, but in the calculation of the total number of positions, they missed it. So it's not creating new positions. The number, we're sort of getting our math straight, but the dollars were there already to pay for it. We just didn't account for the positions as numbers for dollars we did. So when you look at it, it's not quite the story the Washington Examiner was telling. Not a bunch of people sitting at the desk writing. In fact, I don't want to preempt Carol's budget. When you look at the administrative costs in our budget, it's about 9% of the operating budget. And again, if you look at other agencies in the country, and not everybody measures it exactly right, it varies from about 8 to 15%, so we're at the lower end of this, when it's back in Jersey. When I started there, it was 12%. We worked it down to around 8 or 9%. So, administrative area, we're doing okay in our buildings. But getting back to the fact that those 260 positions, 160 are for doing the capital program, which expanded to improve the, ultimately improve the infrastructure here. 60 is something we're looking at, whether it'll be a 65, whether it'll be an actual cost saving by replacing contract employees. The conclusion there, that's there. You know, there was a math mistake previous year. Yeah, you don't want to do, but that's what happened.
Thanks, Mr. Sons, for coming today. With all the fiscal challenges the Metro has, how does the Chief of Police propose to increase public safety officers at high risk stations, either high crime stations or on platforms where it's promised that a situation will unpause it in day one? If it's not going to reprogram money for random ag searches towards improving public safety.
In the police department over the last 6-7 months, they've introduced MetroSTAT, which is like ComStat, so what the police department has, which allows them to more closely analyze crime trends as they're beginning. It also allows them to better deploy their forces. What the chief has done more recently, you'll notice it at Gallery Place, you'll notice it at Long Pond Plaza, especially at night, is there's more officers there, and he's redeployed from other special details. He also is taking some folks off the desk jobs that's been in that place, getting those folks out of the jobs, so you're going to see more people out there. I've also noticed see more dogs out there, part of the patrol. there's been a beef up in that patrol. I'm not going to get into the whole access discussion because that's going to be discussed at the board next week. I just want to say that people actually swab the bags, or not our folks, the TSA folks, and by and large, the money that we use from it is a special grant that can only be used for counterterrorism. I'll let the rest of the discussion go on. But we have stepped up every year.
Congratulations, and I pass.
Thank you. On both counts.
This question is more of a follow-up on the staffing situation, because we had a presentation about a month ago or 2 months ago of the elevator-escalator situation, and part of the problem was that they were running out of supervisors and he had not been able to hire supervisors, et cetera, et cetera, and regular, you know, employees, because of there was a freeze in hiring. And I just wanted to know what steps are we already filling up all these positions? What is the situation? Because otherwise, it really doesn't matter. You know, it's not going to be improved in the near future if you don't hire the people to.
I think on the supervisory end, I think the vacancies have been filled on that. I don't remember offhand on the mechanics themselves, and they still be working on this. But what is important is that next week at the customer service committee, I believe it is, you may recall that the boards a few months ago asked for more information on performance indicators with regard to escalators, and so you'll see a presentation on that which gets into more detail. Have a look at this. Things that we made part of the vital signs that customers can more relate to. I mean, it's hard to relate as a customer to where 85% or 90% of the escalators in operation. You know, it's hard to relate to what that means to the person. But you'll see a lot more so you can relate to it. Part of that's one part. The other part is we put Rodrigo Guitar, who is a senior manager in terms of all insurance and outcomes superintendent for elevators and escalator unit. And he is using the data that has been in the Maximo system, which is the maintenance management system, and beginning to look at that to more carefully pinpoint where we should be focused with our preventive maintenance, which should be a lot better about that, as people worry about, and how we should do it. So I think there's a lot better analysis going on, and better analysis usually leads to better solutions. What comes out of that in terms of the need for staffing is yet to be seen, but that's one of the things I would come out of that. But also, it's just the management of it, what you focus on it, how you focus on it. That's all part. So you'll see a number of action items that will be presented next week.
Thank you.
Well, first, just a comment. While the rail system, of course, has the past several years been at the forefront of everyone's mind, please let's not forget about one of the other thirds of WMATA, I guess I should say, the bus system. I was reminded just today by a fellow passenger that several of our bus lines frequently, you know, fights break out on the buses. You know, the service is not always what you want it to be. Our bus service has its challenges, too. But just to undercut my own point, with regard to the rail system and station upgrades and upgrades to the system that we're looking at in the immediate future, perhaps you heard about the rather horrific accident on the New York City subway system recently. The passenger who was killed, he was on the tracks and wound up getting hit by a train. And the issue of installing the barriers with doors that only open when a train is in the station has been raised in New York, and looking at just sort of the quantitative costs and benefits of those that option. Is that something that has been looked at as part of the station upgrades or improvements for WMATA in any sense? from within the rental industry of what the, like, on paper costs and benefits might be.
I know it's used in Europe, I forget where, someplace, Michelin. There is a significant cost. I mean, years and years ago, in my experience, we once looked at it, I think, in the past. We've got such basic things to take care of right now that the idea of trying to introduce that, which I understand is a safety measure, but also has other benefits, it just can't be on the table right now. We've got the whole, after we take care of the real basic stuff, we've got the question of additional fleet, take care of another safety issue. So I'd like to see the transit authority, see what they do with it, and learn from that, and let them, you know, be the first one out of the box and deal with it, because of the other issues. Yeah. It's a good thing, it's just working for it. And I know we're getting close to time here, so it's great. And I do could want Carol to get home tonight.
Just have a few more.
Could you tell us where we stand on development of the collision avoidance system and the subsequent return to automobile train control?
There's a couple things there. The one is we have to replace the track circuit modules. And a contract's going out to do that. We've already placed some, but the contract's going out to do that to finish it on the red line. Follow through on the other ones. So that has to be done. The other thing is, National Transportation Safety Board recommendations was to do a systems analysis of our signal system, ATC, if you want. And I would not be comfortable going back to automatic train operation until that analysis is done. And any risks that they may find that should be mitigated are addressed. So there's not an exact time because we have to get the results of analysis, which I think comes, I think it's complete this year or early next year. I don't want to take off time. And then you got to deal with whatever recommendations come out of that.
Two questions for you. One, have you had the opportunity to do any outreach toward those that ride the bus? If so, what are you hearing? And then what are your plans for the buses?
Well, I'll take the second question first. With regard to the bus system, we're getting new buses every year. The bus fleet is probably the youngest that has been maybe in the history of Washington Metro Illinois. Only meant to hold the old buses from DC Transit. So it, the bus itself is pretty young, which is great because A, customers enjoy the buses more, and B, they're more reliable. That's the first thing. The second thing is we are going to work very actively, especially with the district, but all the jurisdictions, to see what we can do in terms of giving more priority to buses. And that can entail traffic signal prioritization, and it can where you have enough bus traffic, you know, the possibility of a curb lane, express bus lane. And we're going to aggressively pursue that and see where we end up. That will be a big improvement for the bus customers. I've done it in New Jersey. You save minutes. It's just a better ride. People appreciate it. With regard to bus customers themselves, we get comments and complaints from them, and just as we're going to, when we're looking at a customer call center, that affects bus customers as much as it does rail customers, so we should improve our responsiveness.
Okay. First, I want to congratulate you on your appointment. I gave you the chance to do the video. You're swearing in. That was really nice. I have two quick observations. One is about the bus. I noticed that the reports say that they lost revenue. One problem I'm having, and a few people have mentioned it to me, is purchasing either the bus passes are primarily gone, but to be able to add it to your Smart Trip card, I think you need to have a greater campaign on where to go to purchase bus passes. I know I go to my local Giant, and the staff members are not trained, so sometimes they tell me they don't know how to use the machine, so they can't add it to my Smart Trip card. The sign is extremely small, so I think that if we had a brochure that explained where people can go to purchase this bus pass, that may help. And my second quick observation is I would like to see, I am a customer service advocate, you know, and I do write down bus numbers and everything. During emergencies, during service disruptions like last week, I really do think that you need to have an emergency staff that's there past 8:30 in the evening, like last week. I think the rail did a wonderful job, but the buses, particularly in the suburban area, it was devastating. And I understand from feedback that I received that people were even asked, at certain stations, particularly Naylor Road, they were asked to leave that area, although there were no buses to take them anywhere. People were stuck because some bus driver said, we can't take you, we're not leaving, or the buses broke down, or whatever. I just think during peak emergency situations, we really need to have a staff in Metro. It's really, to me, about perception.
Staff to do what?
On that you can call in to find out if your bus line is running, if there's a problem or something during. We have a number of events in the city, and oftentimes you can't, there's no one to call after 8:30 in the evening.
You're talking about major storms?
Major storms, major events, even on the weekend, like October 30th, we had that, you know, that big event here. Just to have people on call during emergency sessions or emergency events to make sure things, that people have someone that they can speak to in Metro.
Okay.
First
one. Person's in charge of that.
I wrote it down.
We have.
No, we do have information, but I can follow up with you.
Okay, thank you, dear. Thank you.
Okay, my comment is similar. My problem is the seniors are not getting seats on the buses. And are the bus drivers responsible for saying a senior is approaching? Can I get a seat? Or can this person get a seat? And my other thing is about detours. A lot of times the drivers are not aware of the detours, and consequently everybody's looking around and saying, what's going on? And people are getting a little upset because the driver doesn't know where he's going also. And I had mentioned, I've been on this board several years, and I had mentioned if there's an emergency and it's known, why not contact the driver and say, you have to go up K Street, you know, I'm not good with directions, but this is hypothetical, I'm sorry. You know, go to K Street and make a right on 17th or something like that, so that the people know.
Bus operations, because I really hadn't heard that complaint too much.
I hear it all the time.
I'm just saying I have heard it, so I want to talk to them.
Yeah. And excuse me, thank you so much for coming.
Congratulations. One of the other sides of the coming budget battles is potentials to increase the incentive to use transit. And is there any verdict in yet about peak periods moving by the fare structure, or any way to brace for, you know,
I think Carol will be reporting to the board in the next month or two on exactly that, having looked at the last fare increase that we had and peak to peak, just what effect it has. So if we get that report.
Charles, we thank you for taking time. We wish we had more time to ask more questions and get your views on things. I hope you're around for a while. I was going to say, I know you won't be a shrinker, and we know that we all look forward to working in the future. And again, congratulations. Thank you.
I just want to say one last thing. Frank does a great job of representing you at board meetings.
We're now going to move to the next item.
Can I take your seat?
Yeah, another presentation. much easier issue of budget. We have with us tonight someone who is a no stranger, Carol Kissel, who is the Deputy General Manager of Administration and the Chief Financial Officer of WMATA, which is going to present to us on FY 2011 Metro budget.
You do a great job. Your group is actually a very valuable component of some of the things that my organization does. We look at, the communication that comes out of your group, some of the conversations with my staff. I know we attend a lot of these meetings and they present, and we did the blogs. And we sort of, actually, it's a good working group, and I appreciate that. I don't get a chance to tell you that often. I'm just going to take you through what I had presented to the board a few weeks ago in the general manager's proposed budget, and I'm happy to answer questions and get all of the details which is wrong. I may skip through the first couple of pages, but go to the next page, actually. At the board meeting, actually, what we did, I don't have the charts here, but we expressed the importance of the metro to the region. And I won't
this is page
that.
32,
yeah.
Everyone.
Yeah. And the importance of the region in terms of, how many people use metro, how many cars we take off the road. And it's really more than a commercial because it really showed the important impact that metro has to the region. We don't talk about that often enough. And we need to talk about it because it goes to how we operate, it goes to the critical nature of Metro, the business community, as you all know, it goes to actually the value that Metro has that sometimes we don't actually benefit from, sort of the transit-oriented development that we have around our station. So we want to sort of paint that picture. We did that with the board in a couple of charts that I provided to them. But we can actually move forward to this next chart, which is really the initiatives going forward. I won't repeat what Rich said. He says it better than I can. City safety repair, NTSB recommendations, promoting the use of public transit. I want to spend some time talking about the operating cost structure and how we developed this particular budget. This is the third budget that I would have presented for Metro. And it's never easy. And I will say that I'm probably smarter than I was 2 years ago. And that's a good thing. I think that any time you change the cost structure of an entity as large as Metro, it takes time. It takes time to peel back the onion, to dig down deep to figure out where it is, where the cost is, what you're looking at. Is it allocated the right way? Really providing what you want, the level of service. And, I think that we've made some progress. I know we've made a lot of progress in that respect. I always say that Metro is one of the largest industrialized companies in the metropolitan region. It is. And because of that, it's got a lot of, we have 11,000 employees. We actually have a very big cost structure. So it takes time to understand that. I think that Rich said it before, when we're looking at our cost structure, I measured it against what other transits do. So here you see a ratio of this, 1 to 10, basically. And it means that most of the cost structure in Metro is providing rail, bus, and Metro Access service. And then you have this 9%, if you will, that is actually, I think, with some gentleman at the end of the table, Joseph, indicated that it was administrative costs. And those administrative costs are real things. They're communications, you pointed out, about communicating with the riders. Those are important things that you really need. They're financial oversight, telling us, where our costs are, how we're using those taxpayer funds, their information technology, so that we can actually be more efficient in how we distribute our fair media, or how we actually, information technology things that we're doing, I think actually that we'll be presenting later this spring that says you can auto-load your fare now instead of going to a Giant or someplace where you really don't know. You can actually do it on the internet at home. So those are things that we're introducing, and those investments are being made, and we'll be announcing that will be available in June. So those are the things that that 9% does to make the system easier to use for the riders. But understanding that cost structure is important because we compare ourselves against other transits, and as Rich said, we're on the bottom end of that. The number is between 8% and 15%, or at 9%. I looked at Boston, New Jersey Transit, MTA, which is a lot bigger, and I looked at Chicago, how long you get those numbers. So you always have to benchmark yourself and figure out whether or not your cost structure is sustainable. Over the last 3 years, and I just spoke to you about budget before, we've actually taken a lot of cost out of our budget, about $165 million, and it happened in a lot of different ways. Yes, we had some organizational efficiencies. Another word for that is, yeah, we had layoffs. We have had layoffs. Then we had organizational efficiencies that had made sense. We've combined departments, or we've actually centralized areas that made a lot of sense. Sometimes that would eliminate a position, and sometimes it would. We've also looked at, post-retirement benefits. Actually, we do a pay-as-you-go system, so we don't reserve for that. We pay as you go. We've done some negative things, in my view, is things that help us. We suspend our leadership program. Those are tough decisions to make. That every city, and I've talked to a lot of city administrators, our jurisdictions who fund us, they've gone through this as well. But then we've done some good things. We've tried to centralize our purchasing, we've invested in some technology, and we've also tried to better staff our metro sales centers so that we were actually providing service at the locations during the peak hours when people were buying fare media, and closing at night when some people were not. So we tried to do a lot of those things. I wanted to give you a snapshot on the next page. You're all familiar of where we were in 10 and then where we are this year. In 2010, we had a $154 million gap, and we were resolved with a lot of one-time things. And at the end of the year, if you remember, we actually resolved it with a 10-cent fare increase because we had a lot of issues with our snowstorms that we actually experienced in December and in February. We drew down on some reserves that we had from the prior year. And then on the other side, on 2011, we had $189 million gap. That's actually the biggest I had ever seen in Metro, and I think we went down the years to determine whether or not that was the largest gap. Most of that was resolved on the backs of riders. A fare increase over $100 million of that. And as you know, we had fare increases and increased rail by 18% and bus by 25%. We did a lot of other things peak to peak. We tried to also do things with the fare increase that came back, which was the cash differential, if you had a smart trip card, trying to get a discount in that respect. And then we looked at passes and things like that. Jurisdictions kicked in some more, $25 million. We had, again, some more efficiencies that we did, and then we had some changes in the Metro Access Service changes with respect to the fact that we did a little bit more with eligibility, and then we also tried to shrink some of the boundaries and then also decrease the fares on Metro Access. Some of those are good things, some of them aren't, maybe not good things to customers. We tried to grandfather riders, if you remember. If riders were in the area that we were trying to shrink the boundaries, we grandfathered those riders so we didn't penalize riders in those areas. We're actually moved there to take that service. So we try to do the things that made sense. In November, I spoke to the board and gave them a picture of what the budget was going to look like for next year. I said it was about an $89 million shortfall. When I am saying I'm actually adding to that, and now I'm looking at the revenue picture, because our revenue is not growing as much as it has in the past, due to a lot of different reasons. reasons, mostly the economic conditions that we're seeing and the unemployment in the region, I'm taking the revenue down by 20 million. That's not to say that our revenue in ridership has not grown. As you all know, we actually are holding our own on ridership. Our ridership has gone up year over year in rail by almost 1%. It's just saying that we're not meeting our budget projections. Whether our budget projections were aggressive, they probably were, but in hindsight, some of the economic conditions were not foreseen by us. So I will make that distinction because I feel that the ridership on rail is going up. On bus, we have more of an issue on bus because I think bus is more affected by some of the economic climate more than rail is. So we have to take those ridership revenue numbers down. And then the general manager challenged us. He said, I need you to take $25 million of cost out of the budget once again. So the next chart is kind of a busy chart. My please have that one chart that's got a lot of numbers on it. But I'm going to take you through it in 5 minutes or less. The first part of the chart on the top tells you where we are in our budget now. We have an $830 million revenue budget. That we get that revenue obviously from rail and bus and access. And we have an expense budget of $1.4 billion. The subsidy is $572 million. That's what I'm living with this year. For next year, the revenue is going to, and this was the November forecast that I gave to the board, revenue is going to go down by a slight amount, which was $5 million, and that reflected the revenue sharing that I was going to have with the regions. So if you take a ride on bus, go to a metro bus, that revenue sharing would go to Maryland. Take a dash bus, metro bus, whatever that portion of your ride was would be shared with Northern Virginia. On the expense side, some of the expenses are the same ones that I spoke to you about last year, the same ones we talk about every year. Labor and fringe. Our biggest cost is labor. 75% of our cost is labor. 80% of our employees, 11,000 employees or so, are collective bargaining positions. All of those positions are dictate the collective bargaining agreement dictates the pensions, dictates the fringe, dictates the wages that we actually have to assume our budget. That's under the compact. That said, as you all know, we are under a currently in arbitration, or the actually not in arbitration, but we have arbitrated our biggest union. We have a ruling that a judge is should be coming down with any day on whether or not the whatever the arbiter has ruled on is a fair ruling or not. And so right now, I reserve the wage increase for the unions, but these are monies that have not been paid out yet. We're relying on the judge to actually determine what that's going to be. And I assume that's going to happen next week, the next couple of weeks. So that might help us in our budget projections if it falls in a favorable way. The other cost growth here that you see here is just maintenance costs for software, hardware, technology things that we, as we grow, we increase our, change our servers and technology increases. We actually have maintenance agreements that increase. And those are just general costs that increase. We have preventative maintenance, which, as you remember this year, we borrowed, I guess you call it that, $60 million from capital to pay for preventative maintenance costs, which are considered operating costs. We're looking to move that back down to the $30 million levels that we've had in the past. And then we had a carryover from FY10, which we plugged in here. So that got to the $89 million on the right-hand side gap that you see. When I plug in the revenue for the proposed budget that the general manager submitted last month, which is a $20 million decrease in revenue, and then we make some other changes here. So you see there's an overtime number of $7.3 million. This is due primarily to a freeze. You remember a few years ago we had a freeze on positions. Everyone had a freeze. And it was a short-sighted freeze because when we freeze positions, we freeze the pipeline that we need to fill bus operator positions. It takes a long time to be a bus operator. You go from recruitment, you go from validation of your CDL license, you go through a lot of things that need to happen, training, and then there's you're finally actually in place to perform bus operator's duties. Because we froze that, we actually had no education classes and training classes, we had no recruitment, we actually were way behind the eight ball. And as a result of that, now what we're feeling is the pain of that. It's overtime that we must pay in order to get the buses and the routes performing on schedule. So we thought, well, we put something in place to fix that, and we do have something in place to fix that, that'll take us about 12 months to finally get to a steady state of a reasonable vacant rate for bus drivers. But the fact of the matter is, I'm still going to deal with overtime probably in FY12. So instead of, we highlighted, because we want to manage that, right? So we highlighted, we said it's going to be $7 million, let's manage through it for the rest of the year. The biggest cost change that you see there is what we call other cost, other structural cost changes. And these are a result of the cost structure review that I talked about in the beginning of this meeting. It takes a while to understand an entity as large as Metro. And when you finally peel back the layer of onions to figure out, you know, how your cost is working for you, you have two actual areas to look at. You look at operating and you look at capital. In some of that analysis that we've been doing, we realized that we had two overhaul shops. And I've been in the transportation and rail for a while. When I was at Amtrak, we had a couple big overhaul shops, one in Philadelphia, you know, one here in D.C. And overhaul shops are dedicated shops that basically extend the life cycle of your asset. So they take a rolling stock, a car comes in, just like your own car, and you get a whole makeover. Maybe you'll do that with your car. But you get a makeover. And basically it extends the life of an asset so run another 5 or 10 years. There are very specific dates that you need to do that. We have been doing that at two very key shops, actually three, Brentwood, Greenbelt, and Carmen Turner. And we have been using the parts and labor associated with those overhaul parts, we have been funding with operating dollars. Those are true capital costs. So what we did is a structural change is we moved it from an operating cost to the appropriate, you know, GAAP accounting, appropriate cost, which is and in doing that, actually, you see the movement between one line item to another, which relieves your operating budget, but it also, you know, if you look at it, it puts a strain on your capital budget because now you've got to find $49 million to fund that. We have done that. In the proposed budget that we submitted last month, we've linked the operating and the capital budget together. So the $49 million is assumed already in our capital budget. And I think it fits the, I do feel that it fits the goal of steady state of repair, which is what we're trying to do with our capital budget, and that's doing it with the rolling stock on the overhauls. So, simply put, that's the biggest change that you see here. On the old way on the right hand column, so you see $572 million of subsidy. The general manager now is recommending and current service levels, and then all the structural changes that we've done, we still need a $72 million subsidy increase, and that's the $644 that you see there, and that's the request that we made to the jurisdictions last month. Based upon Rich's objective, and you heard it today, he does not want to cut service. It's not in his interest. He wants to maintain current service levels. So in order to maintain current service levels, you have to increase your subsidy level. And if you did that, what we said is, this chart just kind of shows you what you buy, basically. You buy Friday and late night service, which is assumed at about a $3 million level. Dubai Saturday and Sunday service, and then Dubai weekend, Dubai non-regional service. And then you have the list of the heritways and the station, late night, all the appropriate dollars that are associated with the current levels of service.
What are non-regional services?
Non-regional services are they're basically bus services that are not bus services that are riding routes within a specific region. So it's whether they're in Maryland or they're in Virginia or they're in the district. So we wanted to give a picture of what that looks like. And this is a very broad, high-level picture. I will say that next week when we might present to the board, we'll be peeling this back and showing very specific dollar amounts for very specific service levels. The board has requested that. The JCC is looking at that as well, because we all know it's very hard economic times. $72 million of increase in subsidy is not an easy decision for our funding partners to make, so they want to look at all options, and they should, actually. So in the budget proposal, we've also provided some other options that our board can look at in order to sort of keep their subsidies at a steady state at 572, and maybe close the budget gap in other ways. And we've laid these out here. Monetization of ground lease. There's several ground leases. I think there's about seven of them. We could do that and possibly get a lump sum of $30, $40 million. The offset of that is that we have to forego getting $4 million of annual revenue a year. We have to figure that out. It's not a very good going forward strategy because you lose $4 million a year annuity in your budget. But it is something that can happen if you wanted to close the budget gap this year. We got a lot of heat and press about the station naming rights, and actually it was really kind of funny reading a lot of that stuff. I enjoyed it. But we have put that on the table. Maybe there's an opportunity to gain some money for station rights. Metro Center is a good one. I had a laugh out loud when I read some of the Navy
conventions. Is that a permanent, the $1 to $2 million, is that permanent? Or
it would be, it could be, we just stuck a number there. So it could be, and the way these deals are structured are very different. It could be a one-time lump sum, or you can just pay an annuity every year. So the $1 to $2 million is really just a placeholder. I wanted to put a lot more than there, but we wanted to be.
Right.
Well,
if it's Metro Center,
it
should be more.
I think so, too. So, the rent and maintenance of the FY 2011 level. So what does it say? It says that, keep the rent and maintenance at $60 million versus bringing it down to $30 million, which is what we've had over the last few years. And it's kind of a misnomer, this preventative maintenance. Preventative maintenance is what it says. It means that you're, it's like when you're doing your oil change in your car, every whatever 1,000 miles in over 6 months. That needs to happen. We do the same thing with our equipment. It's preventive maintenance. It needs to happen. It extends the life of your asset to some extent. But the fact is that it's really just regular maintenance that you have to do in order to get to the extended of the life of the asset, not the big overhaul. So it's just funny with these what we call these dollars that we get from the federal government, which are called preventative maintenance, and they're considered operating dollars. So, and the reserve for wages that actually is the arbitration issue last year. So we reserved for the last 4 years. If the arbiter or the judge comes into a ruling. Whatever that ruling is, if it's a ruling that lowers what the collective bargaining agreement or union wants for wage increases, and if it's lower than that, their increase was 3% a year, I think that was their position, we could actually reverse what I have on our books now because it's reserving for that potential that we have to pay out. And it could be $35 million, actually it could be more depending on what the judge rules. So those are a couple options that the jurisdictions can use to close the funding gap if no subsidy is available going to the subsidy. So what we're doing next week is we are doing a presentation to the board. I will be doing it, which shows the expenditure category year to year to year. The board wants to do their fiduciary responsibility, making sure that our cost structure is the right one, and it's just the typical review that we do. So we'll look at expenditure year to year in big cost categories. We'll have a big discussion about that next Thursday. And we'll also talk about service levels. We will have the detail on service levels and talk about late night, weekend, things like that. And that'll be the beginning, if you will, of the real detailed discussion that we have with our board. As you know, our budget book is online and is available in great detail. It's a proposed budget book. Actually, we did a lessons learned on this particular budget process. We had a whole list of things that we forgot to put in there. So, some things are minor, but we'll be doing that, obviously, with the final budget that comes from as well. So that's it. And I'm happy to answer any questions. I know I went over pretty quickly. I apologize.
Gave a very thorough and complete account. We keep us somewhat on time. I'm only going to have time for about 10 minutes worth of questions. So we'll still go around, and you just for the benefit of the new members, our custom here is to raise your nameplate like this, and that way I'll know if people have a question to ask. So. Oh. Is that really up here?
Yeah.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Chris and David.
I'm just curious if what feedback you may be getting from the jurisdictions on the increased subsidy. They don't like it, of course.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out the feedback that I've got personally from them to address your question. And then my staff has got some. I will say we had a JCC meeting my staff attended last Friday, and the JCC was looking at service. They're looking at things like, they're looking at service levels, asking questions about service levels. So I think they're trying to figure out where there are some deficiencies that we can make, that they would like to make. I heard from Maryland that they don't necessarily haven't disagreed with an increase in subsidy, but they haven't agreed to it either. So I haven't had anyone come out and say, absolutely not, which is different than prior years, as you know. So I think it's going to be interesting.
My question is sort of a follow-up to Chris's. When are you going to know more about whether the jurisdictions are likely to come up with more? And in the meantime, what would you like the RAC or other advocates to do to encourage the jurisdictions to come up with more?
Great, great. Well, I'll answer the first one and then definitely the second one. So the first one, it's probably going to be, it will be the calendar that I'll lay out. It's next week, we'll be talking about expenditures and a little bit of service, just questions. In March, we'll be talking to the board about capital program will be discussed. And then in April, we'll probably be talking about revenues. And then in May, they have to make a decision. So that's how it's going to lay out. In terms of, I can't predict what the jurisdictions are going to do. I do know that Rich and myself are required to testify at MTA in Maryland, and then we testify at the district in Northern Virginia. And those are scheduled because everyone is preparing their budgets. Rich and I spent some time at the COB today talking to the city administrators and laying this out for them as well. So there's a lot of, like you're doing, nods at the table, and everyone's kind of, you know, holding it close to the vest. I do know that's the schedule, and everyone's aware of it. We'll be very open about it, and, you know, trying to get to a decision by then. On the second question, the Writers Advisory Council can be as vocal as they can be on our behalf, on Metro's behalf, not necessarily on our behalf, but, I think that's important. I think there are going to be public hearings. Yes, I do think there will be a public hearing, maybe one, hopefully, not six or eight. But I don't mean to say that long because I know sometimes you can have one public hearing, it's very difficult for people to get to another, so maybe there'll be others, but I think the public hearing will be so that people can talk about the budget, not necessarily a public hearing for service tax. And I think the board will be, is probably going to be approving the public hearing. So what the Writers Advisory Council can do is to provide some, advocacy, if you will, for the positions that can be reflected from a larger, wider group. I think that's really important. Whatever that advocacy is, and whatever the results are, that would be very important for this hearing, but I do know that they're probably true.
My question is really just a quick question. Do you think that where we are now, as far as the fare levels in the system, which I the first time I'm hearing that Metro budget lost revenue over the last year, but I think I remember seeing you testify that the peak of the peak surcharge didn't produce the revenue that the system had hoped that it would keep, that it would produce. So do you think that we probably are at a level in this region, at least now, that people would say, are saying, that's what I will pay? Or do you think that we can go higher than that?
That's a very hard question to answer. I mean, I think that that has to be looked at in terms of, we have a very different market here. I mean, 40% or maybe even higher, or maybe it's 50% of our riders are subsidized through SmartVote. And so what happens is it skewers the analysis when you look at price points. That's kind of your question, Joseph. And what happens is those people are not really feeling that price point. So it's easier for them to make the decision to ride, which is a good thing. But it skewers what happens to other people who are not subsidized through SmartVote. So that's a very difficult analysis to do. And we have to be very careful about that other side of the equation because people are going to make a decision, and people have already have potentially made a decision that says, gee, if it's going to be $15 a day because I'm going from point A to point B in the outer end of the system paying for parking, then maybe car sharing or riding in and is a better way for me to go. Gas prices affect that. Rider behavior affects that, things like that. I think it needs to be looked at on a daily, on a regular basis, not a daily basis. So I can't answer your question. I do know that the growth in this regional area is going to be enormous, and we will get 2020. So do I think that we're going to have a lot more people riding our system? Yes, there's no doubt about it. And even though we haven't had expansion in our six-year capital program that Rick spoke about, we are laying the infrastructure for that expansion in terms of power and things like that, converters and things like that need to happen because we know that eventually we're going to get to that. So, that doesn't really answer your question, but
I have Penny, Sharon, and Diana, and then I'm going to have to close the queue because we only have about 3 minutes for three more questions. So, Penny.
This is probably a little bit more of a comment, but I would like to quickly commend the general manager and CEO and staff for at least taking the initiative to ask the jurisdictions for what Metro truly needs to avoid operating service cuts, as opposed to immediately jumping to proposed service cuts or fare increases, which was not always the case in the past. And I just wanted emphasize that we really do look forward to getting into the details and seeing how some of the proposed cost savings might impact riders. Because I remember a slide which was in here that was presented to the board that kind of outlined a little bit of the general areas of proposed cost savings.
Yes, I didn't include that, and we had a couple of them. I just got my letter today, actually, doing a health dependency audit coming later today. And, it's something that a lot of companies do, a lot of large companies do, we've never done. Verifying the dependence. You have a spouse, they're on your health plan, you have a child, you have a health plan, those are the appropriate things to do. we're actually can save a lot, millions of dollars with regard to that. The technology that we're putting in the parking garage is that some of you notice we have debit credit card readers, and hopefully they'll be in every lot by the end of this year. There's one lane that's currently carrying a debit credit card. But the technology of that, and they'll have a centralized office that actually will be able to lift the gate. So if you don't have a debit credit card, you don't have a smart trip card, you definitely won't be stranded because you'll be able to push a button. We'll lift the gate for you, and just that technology alone will be able to save some operation dollars by we don't have to man the lots because people are. So you're right, we didn't put that slide in there, but there's a lot of things that we're doing that can actually save some money.
Sharon?
Sure.
Very quickly, page 34, you speak of deferred set aside reserves for post-retirement benefits. But you still, are you showing them on a yearly basis? Because those are fixed expenses that you can get, they're not arbitrary.
Those are contracts that we will never break.
We may break them at some point.
Well, you can't really, I mean, it's very difficult for these to retire reasons, but yes, to answer your question, you pay as you go. So every budget, I know what, based on actuarials, what my retirement benefits costs are going to be, and then we fund it.
I just said that because you have a friend that works for United and they renegotiated all of their retirement benefits,
right.
And I don't know if you're under the same umbrella. I'm just kind of throwing that out. The other thing is, has Metro, and does Metro outsource any of their departments to the point where, in other words, like customer service, their concerns with overtime or whatever, have they ever thought about outsourcing that type of department so you can reduce the fringe benefit?
Great question. And we look at outsourcing, or I do all the time. And difficult because you want to be very cognizant of your collective bargaining agreements. And so some things we just absolutely cannot outsource. And so the things that I'm looking at are things like, and we've done some stuff already in terms of the cash collection. We actually outsourced our cash collection. In terms of cash counting at our revenue collection facilities. So what happens is we have someone who picks it up, a bank picks up the bag of cash and then deposits it at the bank. We don't even count anything. The less we can touch cash, the better. It's not a core service of ours. The thing that we look at is if it's not a core service, okay, then and if we can outsource it and there's cost efficiencies, there's value, There's other benefits that go along with that, and that's an area that we're looking to make. And there's some on my game plan now that I don't quite talk about now, but we are looking.
Okay, Anna, last question.
This is a fine issue, I think, for follow-up, but just your answer to Joseph's question about price increases and elasticity or lack thereof. I think you threw out a statistic that 50% of rides are subsidized by smart benefit, which I just think that's an interesting number. I've never really thought about that, and I was hoping maybe we can get some information on that, because I know that's something that's talked about quite a bit in terms of the federal workforce. That's different from subsidized through some sort of transit benefit program, and I was just curious as to whether that was rides or riders, which is potentially two different things, and so maybe we can just get some information on that.
Yeah, and I appreciate that question. I'll get some information for you, and I'm trying to figure out if my numbers might be wrong, but if I had to think of riders, okay, it would be, maybe 250,000. I'm thinking that that's the number that we've started looking at. That if you want to put it into riders that get smart benefits. And that would be, I'm thinking more about the federal portion. But there are some smart benefit people who are non-federal.
Right. There's like smart benefit if you're a federal employee, and then there's like a subsidy, like a tax exempt subsidy.
We have pre-tax employers. We call them pre-tax employers, non-federal government. And those pre-tax employers would also provide a partial benefit or a full. We have some of those. We can provide the rest with more information.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Carol. And we do have a committee established on budget, and they'll be looking into recommendations from the Act of Board and during the deliberations they may pull on your office for further information.
Well, I welcome that. So. Well,
thank you very much. Okay, moving right along, Paul Seip, who is the convener of the Budget Committee, suggested something that was brought up by David's question, and that is that the RAC pass a letter in principle tonight to the jurisdictions requesting that they increase their subsidies. We wrote a similar letter last year, and you have that in your packet after the budget presentation. This was the sample letter that was sent last year to the various jurisdictions.
Page 41.
Page 41, thank you. And the two blank lines were filled in for each jurisdiction. The appropriate name and title and what the percentage of the formula was. So if someone, Paul was delayed at work, I thought he would be here by now. If someone would like to move that we pass this letter, we could vote for it. David?
I move that we pass the letter in principle 551 in from last year.
Is there a second? Any seconded? Any discussion?
Yeah, I thought we sent this letter.
We did, and now we're going to send it this year for this budget.
And it's the same exact letter.
That
one last
year. It would be written
as opposed to the amount that the in principle is basically the same letter.
It's the same action that we're asking for. Carol?
How did you come up with an amount?
That was last year's amount.
Oh, so they're going to be the same?
They would be modified.
What was the formula?
There's a complicated formula for allocating a cost.
Okay.
So that amount was allocated to the different jurisdictions.
Okay.
Okay, seeing that there's any other discussion on this? It seems like we could take a vote. All in favor? Raise your hands. All opposed? Any abstentions? Okay, the motion passes unanimously. Glad we were able to do that. We now move on to approval of the past meeting minutes. Moved, okay. Many people already provided John with some corrections, and he corrected them. A second? Okay, second. Well, as long as there's no objection, we'll consider them moved.
Who's the seconder? I'm sorry.
Okay, Pat Daniels of Saints.
Okay.
You received in your by email the RAC chair and the AAC chair reports. Are there any questions or comments on those? Any?
Just a quick question, Frank. If the RAC will have a chance to reiterate to the board its recommendations regarding that inspections before the board makes its recommendations to CEO.
A great suggestion. I don't know what the mechanism for that would be.
I guess someone can move that we just send the follow-up letter reiterating the issue. We could do that, and then someone can draft that letter, and we could approve it using our usual process. Do you want to do that?
to stay.
Well, you're moving back.
And I'd be happy to help draft the letter.
Well, I would move that we would send the same letter, but that we would just have two sentences before it, something to the effect that, although we understand that our general manager, CEO Sarles, has gone on the record as publicly announcing that there will not be any change in this program, we urge the board to consider the RAC's recommendation that this program be halted.
David and Sharon.
Or
Carol.
Yes, I'm just saying. Any motion?
If any. Right, motion seconded.
By, I'm sorry?
Penny.
Oh, no, by whom?
Penny moved it.
Penny moved it. That's right. I thought you said.
No, someone needs to say that.
Okay, I'll
need to ask what someone's going to say.
Someone's going to say. Chris Schmidt. Okay. Do we go to discussion or do we follow the queue?
We should go to discussion on
the motion.
We should have a new queue if you want to talk about that specifically. Which is what I put my sign on. I don't know if Carol was on for that.
All right, David.
I would suggest that we also just add a sentence. In addition to what you said at the top and then our resolution below that, I would suggest that we have a sentence to the effect of that it's been raised, questions about whether the CEO, as we had recommended, the CEO be responsible for making more decisions, whether it's appropriate for the board to take action, and that we feel that, while the CEO should be making specific decisions, in our report, it was always our intention that the board be able to review the decisions for one, for especially when it pertains to significant policy implications. And this is such an occasion. That might be the exact wording, but we can respect it something along this way.
Okay. I'm going to put myself in the queue since I don't see any of this.
Carol.
Oh, Carol, you want to talk about this? Okay.
Yeah, maybe I misunderstood what he was saying, but I got the impression what he was saying is the board is going to take up the issue
next week. The next week.
And that his position is that he's not going to stop the exercise of authority, but he's not going to stop the scanning or whatever you call it. But he understands that the board has the authority to make a different decision. So I didn't hear what you kind of summarized. He said he wasn't crystal clear, but that's what I interpreted to be. But for right now, he's standing by his decision. The inspection will go on, which of course is counted with the RAC by majority vote asked the utility to stop. But I don't get the impression that he's saying that the board could well come out with a different decision. So it does seem to me to be appropriate that we say something to the effect that we're reminding the board of our position and reminding of the hearing results and ask them to take this into consideration as they make their decision. That's what I.
I just want to report that.
See, I wasn't clear on this at the last meeting in terms of how far his authority can go. And I think the two titles, being the GM and the CEO, I'm getting the impression that, I don't know if the board is going to override his decision to continue the searches. I'm just not clear on where the authorities, who has the final authority. They delegated him. Well, they hired him as a GM/CEO. And with that comes certain rights and responsibilities. And if they're saying that you can't make this decision, I'm just wondering whether or not the board would overturn his decision. I heard what he said tonight. It seems to me, I think he mentioned a committee. I don't know if he said the board, but I think he said that they had formulated a committee from the board to discuss that issue. And I'm just wondering whether or not
this is going to be really the first test of the first battle of his authority. That's just my concern.
Two things that I'd just like to report from the board meeting is that after I gave them our resolution, there was discussion among the board members, and two items came up in that discussion that I thought were important. And that was that some board members are looking at this as security versus civil liberties. And I think that we, in our resolution, wanted to get away from that division or that binary opposition. And also, but at any rate, I think that it's important that we reiterate our position, because I think I think that some of the board members didn't get the message the first time. Carol?
Yeah, and just to speak to Sharon's point, as I recall, when we had our first presentation with John Cato. Okay. At that time, it was stated that the board had delegated him the authority to make the decision. So I'm assuming that that hasn't changed regardless of what the title changes, and therefore the board can withdraw that delegation from that position. I don't think his being the CEO still does not, unless they do something very different, radically different with governance, still the board has the ultimate authority, to make that change without withdrawing the delegation. So that means to me the board ultimately has a decision if it wants to delegate the decision to the GM.
David?
As Carol was saying, is correct. There was a discussion at the board meeting about this issue, just because it's not 100% clear, who has authority, but ultimately the board has all the authority in the end. So they can make any decision they want to, but we just recommended that the board delegate more to the GM, to the CEO, and not get involved in every little decision about how many cents the smart trip should go negative or what have you. So it was pointed out by some people that, well, does that mean that really it's not appropriate for us to be suggesting that the board review and possibly overturn this decision? But my view is that what we said was that the board should, ask for recommendations from the CEO about things to do, and then say yes or no, we like that course of action, we don't like that course of action, as opposed to, increase by 5 cents, decrease by 5 cents. But that doesn't mean that they shouldn't be involved at all in possibly weighty decisions where things like civil liberties, serious rider, complaints, and so forth are involved.
I remembered my other point. So I'm going to add it now. It was that the presence of a credible threat, which both Chief Taborn said to us and the offices of the January 3rd meeting, said there was no credible threat. Yet board members reiterated that they believe that a credible threat exists. So I think that would be another point that we need to.
I consider all those suggestions friendly.
Going back to the credible threat, didn't we address that in our resolution?
Yeah.
We did address that already.
Yeah.
So that's already, our position on the credible threats was already in the resolution.
Right.
So most
right.
of the, I think that at this point, the way I understand it is that the board is more for policy making, and the general manager is for day-to-day operations and whatever comes up. Right? So seems to me that the bag inspections, whether they consider it policy making, I would consider it policy. So that is the issue that I would present in the follow-up letter, that I think that the one we have is fine. It's just, like Penny suggested, just have, you know, blurb at the beginning, and that should be about it. Because we really specifically, we go into all the details, and so does our resolution.
So, let's vote on the motion. Penny, would you please just state it?
I move that we send a letter to the board. Oh, sorry. I move that we send a letter to the board in light of GM CEO Sarles going on the record saying that the bag inspection program will remain, at least for the time being, that that we remind the board of our concerns and David's additional language as well. We reiterate our position and encourage them to consider it in their review of the program.
Okay. All in favor? Okay. Any opposed? Opposed? Joseph and Pat Daniels?
Okay.
Any abstentions?
Maybe she needs to abstain.
Patrick abstains.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
And everybody, Danny, you were in favor, right? Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Can I ask a point of information just real quick? The letter that the ACLU wrote to Metro, is that in the public domain? I'd like to see a copy of the letter and Metro's response. Is that a possibility?
I don't know. I can see, I think that the ACLU anyway copied the RAC on its letter.
They did?
I'm not sure. I'll look. I'll see. I don't know if the response. I mean, I guess and let me just add that the point of next Thursday's meeting is to consider what the RAC and the ACLU and I believe MetroWriters.org has presented to the board. So they really haven't had a sort of in-depth discussion about the topic yet.
Okay, we're going to move on to committee meeting planning. Elevator and escalator and bus.
We had to postpone our meeting due to the weather last week. We will have our first meeting Monday, February 7th at 6 o'clock. There is a report on the website. It's quite extensive, and we divided that report. It's about 325 pages. This report was written last year, I believe in the summer. Was it in the summer?
Fall.
The fall? Somewhere in the fall. And I've gone through the report. It's really quite interesting if anybody has time to read that. So we will have our first meeting on Monday, and I do believe the new czar field.
The Rodrigo Bitar, who was mentioned by Mr. Sarles as the new head of our elevator and escalator department, will be there. That's Monday at 6 p.m.
Monday at 6:30 or
6?
6.
We're not sure where it's going to be because I think Patrick, you're meeting
with me. I was just going to ask you. I know it's not going to be in here.
We already talked about that today. I remember you today.
It'll be either across the hall or next door. Or, I mean, across the lobby or next door.
I'll
let you know once I get a room cleaned out.
It's not a problem. When I come to yours, mine is for it.
Yours comes at what, 5?
5:30.
Okay.
So you'll start at 6.
6 o'clock.
Thank you.
And bus will be at 7 that same day. We encourage new members to come join us at bus committee. We're going to do an overview of Metro Bus's organizational structure, so we're all on the same page. We're also going to get an update on recent and planned changes to bus fare media, including phasing out the paper fare cards, phasing out the paper bus passes and weekly passes, and then also phasing out, from what I understand, the tokens as well, how that might impact riders. So I encourage you to be there. Patrick, I'm really sorry we scheduled it at the same time as your committee. That was when we could get our perceptors.
Time is precious.
John, did Paul suggest the date for the budget committee?
He did not, and he did let me know that he's not going to be here tonight.
Okay.
So
that'll be said by email then, and be informed. Long-term projects,
I think we're going, John was going to look into whether we could get something on the 7,000 series.
And what I heard back is that they won't have the, as Mr. Sarles was discussing, that they're meeting with the interior designers. They're not going to have stuff ready to present until early March.
Industrial designers, not interior designers.
Yeah, I said industrial, right? Oh. Carpets, curtains? Sorry.
Mood lighting. I will work with John to figure out a topic for the important long-term issues that need attention in the near future, and then we'll send something out. If anyone has suggestions for long-term issues that they would like to hear, let me know after the meeting.
Thank you. We now have 6 minutes to do a 25-minute topic. So what we're going to do is maybe just go around the table and introduce ourselves by name, occupation, and residence. And next month, at first thing, we'll go through the topics of interest. We do have four committees that are going to be meeting this upcoming month, so I think that there's plenty of committees for you to go to. We won't have to start establishing any new ones this month. It can wait until next month. So I'll begin the introduction by saying I'm Frank DiBernardo. I'm a resident of Greenbelt, Maryland. I serve as the executive director of New Ways Ministry, which is a Catholic organization that works for lesbian, gay, justice, and equality.
I'm Penny Everline. I live in Arlington. I'm a social worker consultant type who works on sometimes issues related to transportation, including the ADA and accessible transportation.
I'm David Alpert. I live in Washington, D.C., in the DuPont Circle neighborhood, and I run the website Greater Washington, which covers issues of transportation and urban planning, including metro in the Washington metro area.
My name is Jamie Bresner. I'm a resident of Alexandria. I work at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, where I manage our user experience operations in a group called Digital Media.
My name is Pat Sheehan. I'm chair of the Accessibility Advisory Committee and consult for this committee as a member on disability issues. I live in Silver Spring, Maryland. I work at the Department of Veterans Affairs in the IT area on accessibility issues, specifically Section 508.
Ron Quitting. I live fairly close to the Grosvenor Red Line Metro, and I just recently retired, but ever since the metro opened, I took it to work every day for whatever, however many years it's been open. I still take the Red Line downtown on a frequent basis. And I said, just retired from being an attorney with the federal government.
Steve Claremont. I live in Springfield, Virginia, and political polling as well as child advocacy.
My name is Joseph Kitchen. I live in Cheverly, which is in Prince George's County, Maryland. I am vice principal and director of external affairs at a middle school, private middle school in.
My name is Kenneth DeGraff, and I live in Columbia Heights, in the District of Columbia, and I work on Capitol Hill for Congressman Pittsburgh.
I'm Carol Carter Walker. I live in Washington, D.C., right across from actually in the mouth of the Bulletin Metro Station. I'm a retired federal manager and an independent consultant and general troublemaker.
And the thing is that she admits to it. Hi, my name is Lorraine Silva, and I live in Arlington, Virginia. I am dependent on the public transit completely. Currently, I'm unemployed, looking if anybody knows anything, let me know.
My name is
Diana Zintel. I live on the near east side of D.C. I am transit dependent by choice, and I one of my main interests here in the RSC is just making sure that that message that some people really rely on the system gets through. I am a Alabama federal and I'm originally from Green Bay, Wisconsin, and very much looking forward to speak on this.
I am Chris from Fairfax County, where I have worn Reuven the road from the Vienna Metro Station to my house. In real life, I work as an analyst across the street for GAO, so I don't have a long commute to the meetings here. That's good. And I guess that's about it until we talk about it, Chris. Thank you.
Thanks. Hi, I'm Chelsea Rockford. I live in Washington, D.C., east of the Anacostia River. I do policy work for the federal government, mostly agricultural conservation and natural resources policy. I tend to take the bus more so than the train, and I'm always trying to advocate or speak up for those of us that live east of the Anacostia River and take the bus.
Hello, I'm Sharon Kahn. I live in the Camp Springs area of Prince George's County. I'm the Director of Education for a training school in Washington, D.C. I always say that I am a transportation advocate because I've been riding, I'm a New York transplant, so I've been riding subway, buses, trains all of my life. That's about it. And I guess I'm the longest serving member on the Ride Advisory Council. Okay?
I think I'm with you.
Patrick and I are the longest serving. Okay. My name is Pat Daniels. I came right after them. I'm between Adams Morgan and Mount Pleasant. I'm here advocating transportation for seniors and handicapped. And I love it. And anybody need a file clerk, receptionist, or anything, I'm looking. Thank you.
I'm Chris Farrell. I live in the Wheaton or Kent Mill section of Montgomery County. I'm a lobbyist, but I've been promised a promotion to human. I'm a lobbyist for federal employees and retirees. I'm the retirement issues. I ride red to green to yellow in the morning, and sometimes blue to yellow to green to purple red trains to get home. I ride on buses sometimes and dash buses other times, and sometimes metro buses too. Particularly on weekends with my bicycle. Thank you.
Well, thank you all. I'm glad we got to know each other a little bit. I just want to say before we close that with the addition of Stephen and Joseph, for the first time that I've been on the council, we are up to our full complement to Herbert. So that's good. Not everyone is here tonight, and so we'll still be meeting folks. But the meeting is now adjourned.